are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Adam Pryor, associate professor of religion at Bethany College in Lindsborg, Kansas. I believe the best sequel ever is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Ian Benz, associate professor at UNC Charlotte. And I'd say the best sequels would be The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises.
Kendra Holt Moore, PhD student at Boston University. And the best sequel is Lion King II, Simba's Pride.
Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania. And the best sequel ever is definitely Toy Story 2.
Rachel Jackson, rabbi at Agudas Israel Congregation.
And I would have to say Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That wasn't a sequel.
That was the first one.
That was the first
one.
I know.
That's not the question that you asked.
You cheated.
Didn't you say best sequel?
Yes. So the sequel came out, and then I was like, no, just kidding.
I'm still really confused.
I'm still confused. How is that the best sequel?
It's not. So I've now confused everyone, including myself.
So go ahead and start.
So today we're talking about religion and evolution. And
so it's appropriate we start off confused then.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Good place to be.
But great
I was also thinking that in our cultural understanding, there's this an idea that the evolution, meaning that which comes next, is somehow superior. But I was also thinking that if we could just go back to the first one, because we've seen what happens later, maybe the first one is actually the best. But if you really had to push me, I'd say Godfather 2. But no, I think sometimes you don't realize, if there's only one of something, you realize how great it is, but there's nothing to compare it to. And then if you have a second one, you're like, oh, wow, this is really amazing. Like Toy Story 2, 3, and 4. Or Shrek, right? Shrek 2 yeah. was fantastic.
Shrek 2 was awesome. Mm.
Shrek 3 also?
Donkey also. And Puss in Boots. Mm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. They were so good. Right.
Well, it was T.S. Eliot. We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time.
Exactly. Exactly. The journey begins when you get home.
And you get to start posting on Facebook about your trip. Or Instagram. I don't know. I'm old.
I am learning a lot about Insta. Or is it the Gram? Like what do you call it?
I don't know what we put on the internet.
Okay,
interwebs.
Boomer.
Instagram.
That phrase is officially dead.
Yeah, so when my students taught me about Instagram last year, I started jokingly referring to it as the Gram. And every time I did that, they would just look at me and shake their head and say, it's not the Gram. And I just kept saying it anyway.
Wait, so you only knew that Instagram existed last year?
No, I knew. I just didn't have an account.
Oh, okay. No,
he's been on the book.
I didn't create one until I got to Germany. Oh, no, I knew. But I jokingly referred to it as the Gram, and a few of the students were like, no, you can't call it that. And so I just did the rest of the time we were in Germany. They all knew what I was talking about. Okay, I got us off track.
I tried so hard.
You did. But in the end, it doesn't even matter.
What, no one's going to break out into song with that one? Come on.
I think it's in everyone's head now, so we're good to go.
Perfect setup.
And scene. So this week, we are diving into the problems of evolution and religion, or the not problems. What's the opposite of a problem? The that's okay that they're together and nobody has a problem with it of science and the Bible, of evolution and the Bible.
Well, typically the opposite of problem is solution.
Yeah, but that implies that there is a problem.
I think just the relationship.
Yeah,
we're just looking at the relationship between, and one lens says that the relationship between these two causes a problem.
And another perspective is the relationship between these two topics does not cause a problem. And they are, and then you can go from there and say, no, they're completely two different things, or here's how I reconcile them, or, you know, however we want to say. But the start of that is to say, here are these two topics. How do they interact?
Yeah. Well, right. So I'll just lay down for the past couple thousand years. We have taken the words of the Bible to mean that God created the world as is. Now, you can argue that the poems in Genesis 1 and 2 are not talking about substance creation and more about giving order to things. John Walton likes to say that it's the difference between making a home and making a house, that mm-hmm. the Genesis is about making a home. It's not about, you know, measuring the studs and building the house and the logistics of that. We only really care about that in the modern age. They didn't care so much about that back then. But the underlying assumption was still that the universe came pre-cooked, that this form that you see is the form that it was. The earth was placed on a firm foundation, and that it rests in the center of all things, and the planets and the stars and the sun and the moon, the trees and the bees and everything is pretty predictable and goes in seasons and in cycles. And God, therefore, is a God of order and not a God of chaos, and the God that made order out of chaos, actually. And so when the theory of evolution bursts onto the scene, it poses an existential threat to that understanding, because it says that the way that we see things today may look stable. It may look like this is the way it's always been because evolution works on such a large time scale. But it turns out that things are always moving and changing and interacting, and they're not just one thing forever. And that poses a really interesting question of then how do we read the biblical witness? I've heard some people say, well, you know, we just need to throw the whole thing out, and that it's just now talks about meaning and all of the logistics of the thing we should just forget about. There are people who say that, well, then evolution must be wrong, or we have to find a way to fit that into the text, and how, no, if you read it in this way, then the Bible actually does seem to give evidence for evolution and gradual change over time. And here's the places where the Bible is giving truth, scientific truth, that wouldn't be known for thousands of years afterwards. And that's not fair to the biblical text or to the biblical authors. That's trying to solve a problem they didn't know existed. The fact of the matter is, they had no idea about any of this stuff. And so they didn't write any of this stuff into the Bible. And unless you believe that the Bible is literally the words of God, not just the word of God, but the words dictated to people that contains all historical, theological, scientific truth, then, you know, you're going to have a bad time.
Well, so one thing I'm... Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that's the problem.
Yeah. One thing I'm curious about, and I know right now we're talking about origins and evolution and, you know, Genesis, but so recently I was reading something and talking about, and I knew this kind of already, but how, you know, was it one of the Psalms, I guess Psalm 104 or something, talks about that the earth is immovable. And you mentioned this mm-hmm. too, that's on solid foundation.
Right.
Zach, and how, you know, so this was, you know, during the time of Copernicus and Galileo and the shift away from geocentric to heliocentric orbits and heliocentric system, and recognizing that the earth moves around the sun, right? So, but why is it that, like, when I hear people, when I read some of the things from individuals who claim that, you know, you have to accept young earth creationism, a 6-day creation, and that if that's wrong and evolution's right, then the entire Bible is wrong and you have to throw the whole Bible out, that, why aren't they saying the same thing with Psalm 104? Because Psalm 104, unless I'm misunderstanding everything, talked about an immovable earth and it's fixed. And, you know, hundreds of years ago, it was determined that was not scientific. I mean, that was not really the case. And so it's for the, you know, yes, there are still people who believe that it's not that way, but for the most part, it's an accepted understanding, and even young Earth creationists tend to accept it. So why is it that if they're arguing that if Genesis is wrong, then the whole thing is wrong, then why can't we say, well, then if Psalm 104 is wrong, the whole thing is wrong? Does that make sense?
It was a big deal back then. I mean,
yeah, but why isn't it now? Because it's wrong. Like, if we use that mentality that if one part of it's wrong, then the whole thing's wrong, we got to get rid of it all, then part of one Psalm 104 is wrong. So if we use that mentality, we got to get rid of it all, which I don't agree with that argument, but I'm just curious, why is that not the argument from
It's easy now? To argue metaphor in the Psalms because they're poems. So if you are a biblical inerrantist, you still feel comfortable saying, well, you know, Psalms are poetry. So when it says the earth is immovable, that's metaphor. Whereas they would say that Genesis is not poetry, despite the fact that it is written in poetic form.
I think there's also, if I may, that there is a hierarchy for many people when we talk about the Bible, right? That there's something more divine in the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And those ones take center stage for many people. And when an argument is being made and you're trying to talk to everybody, people know, secular people, religious people, fundamentalist people know Genesis. But not everybody, especially the secular group, knows anything about Psalms, including how to spell it, because it's a hard word to spell. It's too many vowels or too many consonants. So I think for me, that's one reason. The second reason is people are full of conundrums and hypocrisies.
it's true.
So you can for every point in the Bible, you can say, see, this is what it says. You can find almost it's equal and opposites, right? It's in that way, it's very physics-like. That, to me, the Bible is much more about the laws of thermodynamics than they are about the laws of chemistry and biology and other sciences, right? Because, you know, we often think about sayings like, they shall learn war no more, let them beat their swords into plowshares. Mm-hmm. But there is another verse which talks about going to war and beating their plowshares into swords.
Yeah.
But we never talk about that verse because it doesn't give us the warm fuzzies that we're looking for. So it really depends on who you're talking to, what their bias is, and why, what point they're trying to come across in that moment. And so when we generally speak about an audience, people know Genesis story. And what's interesting is that we talk about the Genesis story, but there's two stories in Genesis. And we rarely talk about that. The very first one for Genesis 1 starts with big creation and ends up with the human, right? Sort of universal creation and ends with the human. The second story starts with the human and ends with universal. It almost pictures itself like an hourglass shape. And we don't often look at it from that relationship either.
So now this is something I've heard, but I'm not an expert, that the creation narrative in Genesis 1 mirrors the dedication of the tabernacle in Exodus 25 to 40, that in a lot of ways, you know, each day the different dedication of each one. And so what the writer is trying to do in making this allusion is to say that in the beginning, God made all of this God's tabernacle. God sanctified all of this in the way that you all sanctify your worship spaces, your little worship spaces. God did that to everything at the beginning. And that's at least one interpretation. Again, one that I have taken from John Walton, whose book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, is definitely worth a read. He was one of my Old Testament professors in college, and an all-around pretty great guy. We used to joke that he's the reason why Wheaton College could have a science department, because at the beginning of almost every science class that I took there, we had to do like a half a day's lecture on John Walton's reasons why Christians can do science.
Okay. Also take a step back, and we've been using translations when we're talking about Genesis 1, and part of our challenge is that when we look at Genesis, the first record of it we have is written in Hebrew. And I had a professor who made the analogy that reading in translation is like kissing through a veil. And I just love that analogy because it's like, well, I get the concept, but I'm kind of missing a lot of this. And depending how you translate, Breshit bara Elohim et hashamayim v'et haaretz, how do you translate that? And one translation that just recently came out by Robert Alter says, when God began to create heaven and earth, it wasn't in the beginning. So I think we have to address what are we looking at, because in Hebrew, Breshit bara is very confusing, and it's such a bizarre phrase, and it has been throwing commentators for 2,500 years. What does this mean? And if we put all of our stock into in the beginning, then we have to recognize what that is saying, just that translation, about our theology. And are we creating ex nihilo? And how does that map with our understanding of science? Right? Maybe we can create ex nihilo, or maybe we can't. Maybe it's when God began to create the heaven and the earth. That doesn't say that other things didn't exist. That doesn't say to think that... Yeah, that other things can still exist. I'm picturing, you know, when I begin to create a cake, I need flour and sugar and eggs, and then I separate them, and then I whip them together, and I put them in the oven, and out comes a cake, right? When I begin to do this. So how we understand the text and the words that it's trying to convey has a deeper, deeper meaning with our theology.
Well, if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Thank you, Carl Sagan.
And you said this is a new translation from Robert Alter?
Robert Alter. Mm-hmm.
I love his translations of the Psalms.
Beautiful. He just finished the complete set of the Hebrew Bible. So I think part of our challenge is when we're talking about this, we also have to recognize not just what Copernicus and Galileo and even those living during the time of the Greeks and the Romans, how science came into their life, right? Kendra gave a beautiful understanding several episodes ago about natural philosophy and what that's done to our world. And our question sort of wrestles in between that. Can we still have natural philosophers in the 21st century? Right? Did those just die out with modern science, or can we actually still have that? And if we still have natural philosophers who are reading the text, is that a problem for modern scientists? So I think that's another wrestling.
Can I ask an out-of-podcast question or interjection, just because I wasn't here last week? So I'm just trying to figure out, so far in the series, have y'all laid out some of the terms, like... I heard, I think, Ian earlier say young earth creationists. Have you talked about like the difference between that and old earth creationism?
I think that's a great point, Kendra. We should really talk about the different kinds of gap creationists, young earth, old earth.
Yeah, because I think it's easy
to
like... Yeah, I just think it's easy to sort of group all these things under broad categories of creationism or Darwinism, evolution, whatever. They're actually really distinct strains and sometimes have very unique concerns when it comes to understanding the role or interrelation between science and religion in the broader sense, or even concerns with like the legal system and what this looks like or what it should look like in public schools. And so I think it would be helpful if we just kind of put that out on the table, even as we've been using those terms and assuming things about them. But yeah, just to like have a shared understanding of it, I think would be really helpful. And so like when I hear someone say young earth creationist, or when I use the term young earth creationism, I'm thinking about people who believe that the earth is between 6,000 and 10,000 years old. And young earth creationists, like Ken Ham is a good example of young earth creationists. And they are the people who tend to always have a very literal reading of the Bible. And if you feel like you're really unfamiliar with what that means, I think a good place to start to like get inside the head of someone who is a young earth creationist is to go to the Answers in Genesis website, which is associated with Ken Ham, who is like probably the most popular of the young earth creationists. But that's not the only kind of creationism. So creationism is like this broad umbrella, and you have the young earth creationism. And the other like major branch of creationism is the old earth creationists. And there's a couple of different ways to be old earth creationists. And a couple of the ways, so first of all, I'll just say in general about old earth creationism is that these people tend to believe, to be in line with evolution on the fact of the like age of the earth. So they would tend to agree that the earth is 4.6 billion years old, and the universe is 13.7 billion years old. But the way that that happens and the way that the universe unfolds is read through a theological lens that people who are strictly like evolutionists in a like non-theistic way would disagree and instead choose a more secular understanding. So if you are an old earth creationist, a couple of ways to interpret the unfolding of the universe are the gap theory and the day-age theory.
Day-age.
Yeah. And so y'all can help me fill in some of the details if I miss anything here, but the gap theory of old earth creationism puts this gap of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. So if you don't know what those verses are, Genesis 1:1 says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." And in Genesis 1:2, it says, "And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." And so the gap theory says that in between those two verses, everything that evolution says about the unfolding of the universe, that's when all that happens in the Bible. And so it's one of these really creative ways to align a scientific understanding of the world with a theological understanding in this way, because you still get to have all the science. It's just implicit in the text. And so you don't have to argue so much about it. You just accept that it's there. It's just unspoken in between, like tucked in between these two small verses. And then you get to move on to the rest of the Genesis story and, you know, do your thing. The other old earth creationist argument is the day age theory. And that's based on Psalm 94. And I don't remember word for word. I could look up Psalm 94, but maybe I should just look it up for the sake of anyone.
Yeah, you go ahead and start. You go ahead and start talking about it.
Okay.
And then I'll find out.
Yeah. Okay, great. So yeah, Psalm 94, there is a phrase in that verse that says, a day is like 1,000 years. So this day-age theory says that even when we see, like in Genesis, we say like day one, you have light, like God creates light or whatever. Each day is not like a literal 24-hour day that we think of in our calendars, but rather it's an extended amount of time and could be something like 1,000 years, because that's what Psalm 94 says. But it encourages the more metaphorical understanding of the word day when we read it in something like the Genesis creation account, so that you actually, by the end of the Genesis creation stories, you are actually talking about more than just 7 literal days, but it could be thousands and thousands of years in which God has created all of the earth. So
yeah,
that's so the other Psalm, old earth creationism.
It's Psalm 90, verse 4.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When I said Psalm 94, I realize now that that sounds like chapter 94. But no.
A thousand years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or a watch in the night, which is then picked up in the New Testament from Peter in 2 Peter 3:8, when the early church is trying to figure out what's going on because Jesus said he was coming right back and he just had to run to the store to get milk. And now it's been a couple years and he's not back yet. What are we going to do? And he says, you know, don't let people say that God is slow. God is not slow as we were defined slow. Do not forget that with the Lord, the day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like a day. So that I have heard that come up a lot in terms of trying to decipher apocalyptic literature in Revelation and Daniel, and when it talks about days and nights, and well, that means 1,000 years because we have this equation going on in 2 Peter and Psalm 90.
Maybe we're just living in Brigadoon.
Oh, I love that movie.
What's that? Hey, you didn't know what Pokemon were, so.
Hey, I know I knew what it was. I just didn't chose not to partake.
That's the 90s, baby. Us babies don't know what that is.
You just wish you could be a 90s baby.
I am proud of my 78 years, sister. Jeez. These millennials, I tell you. To all millennials listening, I love you because I do teach some of you. And Kendra knows my affection.
Yeah.
Just real quick, Brigadoon is basically a rom-com where there's this quaint little town that's been this cute little town, and it's covered in fog, and the rest of the world, you know, goes on and lives without it. And then one, you know, every day that the town wakes up, right, the fog lifts and they're like, oh, look, isn't this amazing? And they just go on through their lives. But what's happening in the rest of the world is it's every 100 years. So a stranger from the regular world magically like finds himself in this town, which feels really ancient because, well, they've never had the technology, and he goes in and he falls in love, and they're like, what are we going to do? If I go back, you're going, you know, I'm going to be here and your grandchildren are going to be dead. So how do we come and save our love together?
And the stranger was played by Gene Kelly.
Oh. Yeah.
It was a wonderful movie.
It was an amazing movie.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to watch it.
I don't want to give away the
Brigadoon
end.
I don't either. That's why I didn't.
Movie. And the way it goes, Brigadoon. Like every single time they wake up.
So, anyway, so it's sort of reminded me of that, which is not a pop culture reference because this is 2019, but it's still kind of a pop culture. Just depends how old you are.
But it's a good reference.
Thank you.
But it is a way of making meaning out of the text. That,
exactly.
Okay, it's doesn't have to mean day and night, the movement of the sun, because there are days in the Genesis account before there is a sun.
That's right. Because we don't get the sun until day 4. So what then? Also, like when we look at, you know, and the earth stood still, right? Moses is holding up, or is his arms are being held up so that they can win, and the sun stands still as long as his arms are up.
You know, if I had that kind of power, it'd be like, no, just sorry.
For those that can't see, Ian is just raising his arms.
It translates very closer. Well to audio.
In a trickster kind of way.
Yeah. Well, so modern now that plays into something I was just thinking about. Thank you for using the word trickster, because there's mm-hmm. two things I just had thoughts about. The first is that I remember several years ago when I was teaching high school science, was the first time that I guess I had really heard someone say that, you know, the placement of the fossils and what we see from all of that was the fossils were put there by God to test us, kind of like a joke, which was the first time I really had heard that in person. And I was really kind of like, whoa, okay. So that's one thing. And another thing I'd love if we get a chance to address it, we talk about the two creation stories in Genesis, is if I remember the first Sinai and Synapses meeting we had in fall of 2017, Adam, you brought this up because I brought up you and I were in a small group together, and I brought up the conflict, or at least the disagreement, between the two creation stories in Genesis. And you said something like that, I guess theologians had come up with a reasoning behind that or something, like a long time ago. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, theologians come up with all kinds of crap.
Yeah. So what crap was that?
Adam emerges.
Yeah.
There have been plenty of readings in Christian history, particularly of Genesis 1 and 2, of the first and second creation stories in Genesis to harmonize these stories, right? Mm-hmm. So one becomes explanation. The second creation story is a deeper explanation of the schematic view that you get in the first creation story, right? So in the first creation story, it's like reading an extended table of contents, and the second creation story then fills in a lot of gaps for you. It's a neat hermeneutical trick that, you know, we use all the time for all sorts of other things. I don't blame anybody for using it. To me, the real question for me that permeates a lot of these discussions about evolution in the Bible is what's at stake for people in the Bible? It has nothing to do with the science at all. All the arguments that get made in order to harmonize or exclude science, right? These all have something to do with the way in which Scripture operates for a particular group of people. And to me, no matter what the labels are that we're putting on the different ways in which people are doing that, that's really what's at stake here. And I don't know. I find that both fascinating and a little irritating. Sorry, I should explain why. Fascinating because I find it inherently interesting that someone values a text that much. Any text. I say that as a professor with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books around me who loves to read. And yet, to give any singular text that kind of authority is fascinating to me. But I find it irritating because we enter into these conversations about evolution in the Bible. And often, we haven't done this, right? But oftentimes what happens is you get these sort of like wonky, really poor descriptions of evolution. And what I want to say is like, just leave evolution out of it. Let's just talk about the Bible and figure out what's going on there for people. And then the evolution thing can kind of take care of itself. Just leave that alone for a little bit. Let's figure out why it is that people are jumping through these hurdles and making these hoops and really, really interpreting in ways that we would find fairly suspect in any other field first. And once we figure that out, then maybe we can have like a more robust conversation.
If I remember correctly, in my readings, when you go down, you know, back in history to people like Augustine of Hippo in the 400s and stuff like that, they didn't necessarily hold to this a literal interpretation of Scripture. Is that?
A little bit. Yes.
Right. So, I like that you just brought it down to the Bible. That to me seems like so for hundreds and hundreds of years where they. Are people trying to argue now that, oh, well, they just were wrong and now we're right?
So it gets difficult because I'm going to stop and compose myself here and get over the 18 million things running in my head because I haven't slept that much and try and focus them into one thing. Okay. So... I have to do that out loud right now in order for it to happen. So
for those of you who don't know, Adam and his wife have a 3-week-old at home.
Yep.
Yep. That's why he hasn't been around.
Probably
should have made that announcement.
Yeah.
Oh, hooray. Welcome back. Hooray. We did all that before people were hearing. Augustine is a really great person actually to bring up. One, because I think Augustine is hilarious and fun. But two, because he's a really interesting character here because you can't categorize him as sort of like a traditional literalist reader of the Bible, right? What's he worried about when he reads Genesis 1 and 2? He's worried about time and that you can't have a beginning if God's eternal. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about the creation story and we talk about the beginning of things, he's worried about that it's not just the beginning of stuff, but how do you define a beginning when you don't have time? That's a heady paradox to try and get yourself around. When he reads Genesis 1 and 2, that's what he's worried about. I mean, he's worried about other things too. But
isn't he the one that said that, I know exactly what time is until I try to define it?
Yep. Yeah, right. So, you know, this is why students for like many, many years in liberal arts colleges have read like the first 9 books of Augustine's Confessions, but then they don't read the back part because that's all about time and nobody understands what's going on.
So they want to read about the pear tree. And
right. You got to read about the pear tree and the sex. That's super awesome. But then you leave like the time part out of it. It's not about stealing pears. I don't care who says it's about stealing pears. It's not about stealing pears from a pear tree. So, right. But I'm sympathetic to folks who do want to make a literal reading because I think it actually goes a little earlier, right, than like we typically say. We would typically, I think you would hear folks sort of put out there that like, look, a sort of literal reading is a sort of an American invention, particularly something that comes up in like the late 18th, early 19th century. It ties in with the Second Great Awakening where it really sort of flourishes. But I'm a Lutheran. I read a lot of Luther. And boy, does Luther read Genesis pretty literally, right?
Okay.
So like, oh, maybe I can find it. I'll look for it here and I'll bring it back in a second. But like one of my favorite quotes from Luther is his quote about Adam before the fall, right? Where he compares Adam having all of these like almost supernatural qualities of all of the best animals that he loses when he falls. It's brilliant, right? That's a pretty literal reading of what's going on in Genesis, right? There are actual like physical characteristics that change in Adam when Adam sins. So what I want to say is like that to me, it doesn't matter whether it's literal or not literal or how it gets read, right? Everybody is reading this text with a certain axe to grind, an angle to sort of get at it with. They have certain questions that they want to answer. And that's going to affect how it is that you're going to relate evolution in the Bible, no matter what. When I think about like, go ahead. I'm prattling now. But I am going to find that Luther quote because it's awesome.
I was just going to add that I think this question about when did we start reading literally versus metaphorically, and I would just add that I think this is something that happens in waves and is related to the people and institutions that are in power at a specific time. And if those institutions are concerned with like the metaphorical meaning of the scripture, then that's what gets reproduced for the public in the form of lectures and books and talks and whatnot. And so I think that it's important to not just think of this like linear arc where we start with the metaphor or we start with literalism and kind of change to the other side, but that it seems more like a cycle. And of course, that is like a more complicated way to understand it and hard to, I think, hold in our minds in a way that makes sense because we like to think of history as more organized and like cleanly cut than it actually is. But yeah, I think it just makes sense to me that the power dynamics of like social roles will really influence what counts as true and what gets reproduced for people to consume and then pass on. And that changes hands when you have like power struggles and war and things like that. But it's never quite as static as we want to think it is.
When I start thinking about that it's not static, that there are sort of shifting and changing questions that have affected how we think about evolution in the Bible, right? When I think about young earth creationists or old earth creationists or any sort of biblical literalism as it tries to relate to evolution, right? Or even like more progressive mainline Christianities as they try to relate science and religion, right? To me, the question is always to sort of ask, what is it that's at stake for this person or this particular group as they're reading this text? And what does, I'll be sort of crass, what does science threaten in that reading such that they need to make some sort of adjustment in terms of how it's being read?
Yeah, I was going to say that much of this conflict comes out of fear, and much of the drive towards literalism comes out of fear. If you're in a place where you feel like your way of life is threatened, your faith is threatened, where people are coming against you with alternative truths that don't play nicely with yours, then you're going to cling to something like literalism because it's easy and it's static. You know, we see a lot in the, one of the big issues in the early church was Paul would come into a place and he would be like, hey, y'all, Christ has set you free. You can go do free stuff now. And it's great and wonderful. And you don't need to worry so much about following the law. Don't act a fool, but you don't need to be tied to this law anymore. And then people would come in behind him and they'd say, well, you really do. You really need to do more. You need to be circumcised. You need to make sure you're still kosher. You need to make sure you're doing this, 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 and this. And people ate that up. You know, if we didn't want rules, if we didn't want clear, easy truth, then those people coming from behind would have an uphill battle trying to convince people of that. But they didn't. The people immediately were like, oh, no, that feels much better because freedom in Christ is terrifying to have my own conscience and not to have an easy set of understandings. And so to look at the Bible and to say, oh, there's one literal reading that is inerrant and ineffable, and it is not ineffable, inerrant and
infallible.
Fallible. That's it. Not ineffable. That's the opposite. it's just so much easier, and it's so much more comforting, and then you can get back to doing your own thing, and that is especially enticing when there is a danger, a threat to your way of life.
Yeah, and I think another example of that, and I think it's one that we've talked about on previous episodes, is just the way the story is told about Copernicus putting out into the public his heliocentric or sun-centered theory of the universe, which some people tell that story as one that's about like fighting biblical literalism, because the sun-centered theory goes against this verse in Joshua that says that the sun stood still during a battle. And so if you say that the sun stood still, that implies that it's moving most of the time. And so the idea is that the sun would be like rotating around the earth. And Copernicus was a natural philosopher, a scientist who says, no, actually the sun stands still all the time and the earth goes around the sun. And so some people paint that story as one that's about like how you read scripture. And some people would say it's not really about literalism at all. It's about Copernicus challenging what the church said, and the church at that time being like a major powerful institution that dictated like what the social norms should be for people. And so if the church feels threatened, then it's more than just a threatening of this like literalist way to read the Bible, but it's a threat, and it's a threat to social order. So again,
to power.
Yeah, to power. And it is a disruption of the way things are. So again, it's just this like destabilizing feeling of, you know, feeling lost about like what your place is and what you can trust and how you can navigate the world that you're in.
Yeah, and I think that's really critical in terms of that idea of how we navigate our world, is this issue of the control that God has in the world, right? That I think is destabilized. And to me, this is actually what's at the crux of the issue when you have these conversations about evolution in the Bible. Does evolution, I'm going to put this in like really heady academic talk and then I'll try and back it down, but like, does evolution threaten two things? One, teleology, and two, divine action. And I don't think they're actually unrelated, right? But teleology, right? The idea that there are ends that are causative, that there are basically designs in nature, right? A good, solid evolutionary account does away with that. And to me, the brilliance of the sort of like early dialogue between pretty conservative theological scholars like Charles Hodge or B.B. Warfield and some of these folks and the early scientific advocates of evolution, to their credit, that sort of first generation of scholars, I think, really understood that that's what was at stake here. that if evolution works the way that it's being described, then I don't need God to bring new forms about in the world. And that means that maybe God doesn't act in the world anymore. And that's a problem for most Christians, mm-hmm. I think, right? And I'm not saying it's a problem for all Christians or that it continues to be a problem, but it's at least a recognizable problem that then explains why I need to do these sort of very particular readings of scripture. That's what I'm really after in that case. But I think tied up with that issue is exactly what Kendra's talking about. The comfort of a worldview and the comfort of a sense of knowing that that level of God's action and design is built into everything that I feel and see around me. There's a lot to be said for that. It's a robust and important view for a lot of folks. And I think we have to take it very, very seriously. At the end of the day, I'm not going to agree with it even a little bit, but I also understand why you would want to hold on to that. It's the moment where I become sympathetic to Ken Ham. It's the only time I'm sympathetic to Ken Ham, right? But if I read him as charitably as possible, I think that's what's really going on.
Say it again. Sorry, you think what is going on with Ken Ham?
Well, not just Ken Ham.
I know, but let's just use him as an example because you just did.
Right. So like, if what I'm really worried about is that when I take evolution seriously, that what I take away is God's ability to act in the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I don't need God's action anymore to create new forms, right? If I take that away, where do I stop taking it away?
Okay.
Right? Where do I draw the line in the sand that this is where God's omnipotence goes and only so far?
Right. Okay.
I don't like that, but if that's the worldview in which you grew up, and there's a lot of comfort in that worldview, knowing that there's that design, knowing that God has that power and ability to act in the world in that way, I wouldn't necessarily want to give it up.
Yeah.
Right? That's disquieting.
Interventionist theology and a firm belief in scientific evolution?
Yes.
Okay, I do too.
Okay, so elaborate for us non-theology people.
Right. So the tension.
What
that
do
I
you
hear
mean by
Adam,
interventionist theology?
What the tension that I hear Adam talking about is a God who acts in the world, mm-hmm. and that's really big. About the world, but what he's really saying is a God who acts in my life, right? It's not just the world. So a God who can say, so when I've met people who say, you know, I firmly believe that my prayers to God about this one particular thing, about being healed, about letting me know if I should take this job, about, right, something that is very, very specific to a person's life. Whether it's a miracle thing in terms of, you know, curing an illness, or if it's a, how do I make this decision? That is a God who intervenes in my life, mm-hmm. the interventionist theology.
Okay.
Right. And can I have this interventionist theology if I don't believe, as Adam was saying, right, to say, well, it removes those things. It removes God from having that ability if I believe in this evolution, the scientific evolution. And to me, those things don't necessarily conflict. But that's sort of one takeaway that I was hearing from Adam's statement, that scientific evolution puts a hole in this interventionist theology.
It takes one more job away
from
God.
But you would just call it theistic evolution,
right,
which
right,
is something right. I think we've used, or I feel like I've probably
we've
used
that
and maybe not like describe what that means exactly. But that would be, I think, another term to put on the table, which is, I think, a mediator between someone who believes in like a secular vision of evolution and someone who is a Ken Ham variety of young earth creationists. And so the theistic evolutionists would do what you're saying, basically, which is to believe in an active God who is like guiding the course of history or intervening some way in your life, but using the tools of evolution. And that is satisfying for some people because you get both of the science piece of like the way the world works, and you get to keep a vision of an interventionist God. But it's not satisfying for other people because evolution is like violent and not always, it doesn't always live up to this vision of like loving kindness and like omnibenevolence that we often attribute to the standard vision of like a Christian God. And so that's something that feels irreconcilable for people. And so they would not partake of that theistic evolution vision.
And I think I'd throw in too that like theistic evolution itself is a pretty wide term. So I think it would be fair to say that there's maybe the bulk of work that was done in religion and science like through the 90s was really centered on this issue. And so there are a variety of theistic evolution positions that will have more or less of that interventionist quality of action.
Yeah. And I don't think I was actually, maybe I didn't speak very clearly. Adding can pause for 2 seconds and all of his thoughts come up in this beautiful sentence. And I pause for 2 seconds and I'm more confused than ever. I wasn't necessarily.
I don't think that's true.
it's true for me. Carry on. Sorry.
It wasn't just theistic. It wasn't just saying that God is controlling the evolution. It's saying, no, I believe in the natural understanding and the natural selection and the random mutations and, you know, the speediness of environmental factors, and that may or may not have something to do with God. And I can still reconcile that with that God will answer my prayer or will talk to me. Well, maybe not talk to me, but will have a role in my life. And a role in the world. And to me, that's not exactly theistic evolution.
So also in the Bible, one of God's other jobs, other than creating things, is regulating the weather. And this is true across most religions. That's probably why people started praying and sacrificing, because the rains weren't coming and their crops were failing. And so, God has storehouses filled with snow up there, just, waiting for the right day. And so you can pray for these things and God will give you weather. And at some point, we realized that there are natural processes involved in creating and regulating weather. And it is 20-some degrees in North Carolina right now, and that's not because you didn't sacrifice properly. That's because the Arctic is warmer than ever and the polar vortex is all out of whack. So we understand those things. But nobody is having an existential crisis because we took God's weather-making power away. But when we take away God's creating, like ex nihilo power, from a word creating a static universe, that is a huge threat to people. And I'm wondering your hot take on that.
Well, I would just say that for some people, I think taking away the weather-making abilities of God would be grounds for an existential crisis, not because of the weather, but because that leaks into other mechanisms of just the way the world works and like the way that babies are made, if you just describe that in terms of like what bodies do and you take God out of it. I think there's a world in which people would say, well, we shouldn't take God out of the weather making, because then you can take God out of everything else that we do on earth. And then you do get sort of this like deistic clockmaker God. So I think that the two things that you described, like the creation, like the ex nihilo vision of creation, like the capital C creation of God, and maybe these like little varieties of making things on earth. I think I see those as very connected, and chipping away at the small creation acts, I think ultimately chips away at the big creation act, and that scares people sometimes.
Can I share a story from the Talmud?
Absolutely. We're nearing the end. That's the perfect thing to share.
Yeah.
Wait, but I have my Luther quote too, so I have to read it. It's so good. Makes me smile every day.
You go first, Adam. Tell us your Luther quote.
Okay.
He does have a really big smile on his face, everybody.
It makes me smile so much.
He's glowing.
It was my favorite thing when I discovered.
Not because of the baby also.
No. The baby doesn't have anything to do with it. I know it's going to be at the end of this episode. So.
You have to do it. You have to do that.
Like, Adam, what do you think about the baby Jesus?
Yeah. The baby has nothing to do with it.
So it goes like this. Therefore, the image of God, according to which Adam was created, was something far more distinguished and excellent, since obviously no leprosy of sin adhered either to his reason or to his will. Both his inner and his outer sensations were all of the purest kind. His intellect was the clearest. His memory was the best. And his will was the most straightforward, all in the most beautiful tranquility of mind, without any fear of death and without any anxiety. To those inner qualities came also those most beautiful and superb qualities of body and of all the limbs, qualities in which he surpassed all the remaining living creatures. I'm fully convinced that before Adam's sin, his eyes were so sharp and clear that they surpassed those of the lynx and eagle. He was stronger than the lions and the bears, whose strength is very great, and he handled them the way we handle puppies. Both the loveliness and the quality of the fruits he used as food were also far superior to what they are now. But after the fall, death crept like leprosy into all our perceptive powers so that with our intellect, we cannot even understand that image. Mostly, I am pretty pleased that before the fall, we clearly played with bears as though they were puppies. Yeah. That is what I take from Luther on this point.
That is pretty cool.
What I have to say does not compare to puppies. Bears as puppies.
Bears and puppies. It's tough to beat bears
it
and
is.
Puppies.
It is.
Can
gonna
you
try.
Add puppies into the Talmud?
You know, I don't know if it'll fit in this paragraph or not, but maybe I'll just throw
you
it
do
in.
Do a random arf.
Yeah. You know what? I'll leave that one to you, Ian. Okay. You can just randomly do
I don't want
to
do it, though, and not know what's coming next. Because I'm going to
So this comes from... Brishit Rabbah. This was Breton plus or minus 1300 years ago. It doesn't have a copyright date. We're not positive. Okay, so there is this wealthy Roman woman of rank and power, and she goes to Rabbi Yossi ben Halafta, who is a preeminent rabbi of the time. And she says, Rabbi Yossi, in how many days did God create the world? In 6, he answered. And since then, what's been God doing? Matching couples for marriage, responded Rav Yossi. That's it? She said dismissively. Even I can do that. I have many slaves, both male and female. In no time at all, I can match them for marriage. To which Rav Yossi countered, though this may be an easy thing for you to do, for God it is as difficult as splitting the sea of reeds. Thereupon, she took her leave. The next day, the aristocrat lined up 1,000 male and 1,000 female slaves and paired them off before nightfall. The morning after, her estate resembled a battlefield. One slave had his head bashed in, another lost his eye, while a third hobbled because of a broken leg. No one seemed to want his or her assigned mate. Quickly, she summoned Rav Yossi and acknowledged, your God is unique, and your Torah is true, pleasing, and praiseworthy. You spoke wisely.
Well played.
And they all got puppies.
And they all... So, for me, that was sort of a... God did the creation thing, didn't quite go away, but then settled on the affairs of matchmaking. Because we all know how difficult it is to actually find a match. Thank you, Fiddler on the Roof.
Did you get that reference, Kendra? Just want to make sure.
Yeah, I've never seen it, though.
Just wait until the Gritty reboot.
No!
This has been episode 17 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. Thank you to everyone who has shared this podcast with your friends and the two of you who rated us on Apple Podcasts this week. We're up to 6 reviews now. Come on, folks, let's show that algorithm that we're legit. You can check us out at downthewormhole.com for contact information, social media, and copious show notes. Next week, we talk about teaching evolution with Michael Zimmerman, the founder of the Clergy Letter Project. He's a super great guy, and you do not want to miss this conversation. And don't forget, applications for the next round of the Sinai and Synapses Fellowship are due December 4th. That's only 1 week after this episode launches. You can learn more about the program at sinaiandsynapses.com. And from all of us here, we hope that you have a happy Thanksgiving. And if you're looking for some reading material while you lounge around this weekend,
you got to read about the pear tree and the sex. That's super awesome.